And for the sermon, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Going to add on to the announcement session here just a bit before I get into the sermon message. There was an event that took place in Cincinnati, and it was a type of open house event, and the topic was, Why Were You Born?, which is always a great topic to cover in terms of helping explain people's place in the world. And I know that Mr. Holliday, in his commentary, mentioned this week that that was one of the captivating questions that really struck home to him when he first came into the church. And we had 74 visitors listen to the explanation of this question by Mr. Gary Petty. So it was, apparently a very, very good, good result. The one-hour seminar had been advertised locally in the greater Cincinnati area for a month. Eight striking red billboards scattered around the city pose the Why Were You Born question to commuters with a URI, or internet site at the bottom in the date of the event. Pandora internet radio ads also asked the question, creating a million impressions over 4 weeks. So overall, pretty good response. Steve Myers, whom many of you know, was the co-host, introduced Mr. Petty at the beginning and invited everyone at the end to a follow-up seminar 1 week later to be held at the home office. So this was held at a Holiday Inn near the home office and attended very well. So it was a good result. So that is – appreciate Mr. Tanner bringing that up. I'd had that printed out, and I think I talked a little bit about it in Sierra Vista, and just kind of glad he brought that to my attention again. Many times when we're evaluating world events, this has seemingly been something that has been traditional within the Church of God. We have analyzed, and I've done a fair amount of this myself, and nothing wrong with it, but we analyze prophetic events in light with recent events that we all go through. And as long as I can remember being in the church, that has been kind of SOP, or standing operating procedure, as to create interest in prophecy and relate it to what is happening during the time and the space in which we are operating in. And it was certainly something that Mr. Armstrong did, and he was perhaps the greatest exponent of preaching about Bible prophecy that we have ever had in the church. A lot, and he brought to the church a lot of great contributions in terms of prophecy and made it simple, simple for you to understand if you're being called. But I listened to actually quite a number of his sermons and Bible studies. He spent a lot of time in England, and I heard him a lot, as much as any of the other campuses or students for the 2 years that I was in Brickett Wood. He didn't come to Big Sandy that much when I was finishing up my senior year there in college, but he came to England a lot, and it was a natural jumping-off spot to go to the continent and visit some of the people that he was visiting at that time throughout all parts of the world, as we talked about in the Bible chat afterwards. So analyzing what's happening today and using Bible prophecy in conjunction with recent events in the world and making association with prophecy is something that we do commonly in the Church of God. But I remember I can still see it on my page from either a Bible study or a sermon Mr. Armstrong gave in 1973 or 1974, I can see it on the page of one of my old Bibles, my first Oxford edition wide margin Bible, where we could actually write in, and we were actually encouraged to write in and take notes and put your Bible study notes and your sermon notes in the Bible itself while you were hearing a sermon. And so I've got a lot of things in my Bible, some of my earlier Bibles, that really don't make any sense anymore, like the King of the South in Daniel 11, King Faisal, who died many years ago, so apparently that one didn't work out so well as a speculation as far as prophecy was concerned. So, you know, although it's okay to utilize current events, and I do it all the time. You know I do, and I like to talk about current events, and I like to talk about what's going on in the world and all of that. I'm not going to do that today, because not that it's wrong to do it, but when I think about a lot of the sermons I've heard myself through the years, a lot of those prophetic speculations, if you want to call them that way, have been abysmally wrong. You know, they're just, you know, they almost, they're kind of like the failed secular prophecies you know, some of the people back in the early, late 60s, like I've talked about this guy, Paul Ehrlich, who was highly esteemed in the time and period in which he wrote his major bestseller called The Population Bomb, in which the prediction was at that time, he didn't believe in Bible prophecy, but, you know, there would be this point at which food production and population growth would far exceed food production, and they referred to his work as the "When the Sickle Meets the Stork" theory. Get it? When the sickle, which you cut for the grain, and the stork delivering the baby, those two lines would cross, and the stork would far exceed the sickle, and like 2/3 of mankind would starve, according to Paul Ehrlich. For some strange reason, some of these nutty guys, like the people who are proponents of global warming or man-made global warming, they still have some credence, and people follow them as if it's kind of a religion, really. It's really like a religion. Even though they've been proven abysmally wrong over the years, people still buy into it. And for what reason, I don't know. But, you know, they use propaganda to really sell the message, like the one I think is my favorite propaganda or myth or lie is the polar bear that's floating on the little small piece of ice about the size of this lectern. And, you know, it's as if the idea that's conveyed is this poor polar bear is going extinct. It's going extinct because of man-made global warming. The ice caps are melting and all of that. And you know what? All of that is nonsense. It is pure stupidity. The polar ice cap is bigger than it's ever been, both in Antarctica and in the North Pole. And there are more polar bears now than there have ever been in the history of mankind. Well, maybe except going back to the ancient ice age. But there is absolutely no proof for some of these secular prophecies. But, you know, when we talk about the association of world events and prophecy, at least we try to strive for accuracy. At least we strive to label and identify those things as not prophetic utterings themselves. And I've had a few people that I've known through the years that have gone way off base and have gone nutty into writing books and, you know, gone way off from the teaching. And some of them I went to class with in Ambassador College, and, you know, they become infamous for declaring that they know this and that and the other thing about prophecy, and they go beyond the Bible and all of that. Those things are obviously, you know, to avoid that like the plague, because some of that is nuttier even than the Paul Ehrlich prophecies on a secular nature. So today we're not going to go into anything in terms of current events and relate anything that's happening in the world in terms of Bible prophecy. Some of you have been around for a long time. Some of you have been around for a relatively short time. This will probably be one of those messages in which you kind of nudge your neighbor and say, I know where he's going next. And you may not know. You may know these scriptures already. I'm hoping that you do know them if you've been around for any period of time. Perhaps I'm not going to say, you make these statements that this is one of the most famous chapters or whatever, and maybe it's to you and maybe it's not to somebody else, but certainly a pivotal, important chapter in terms of Bible prophecy, and one that's considered to be somewhat difficult to understand by Bible students because they don't have the keys of prophecy that you and I do, is found in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, and it's called the Olivet Prophecy. And according to Expositor's Bible Commentary, these chapters are considered some of the most controversial. They're all basically the same, covering the same topic, happened at the same time. But according to Expositor's Bible Commentary, few chapters of the Bible have called forth more disagreement among interpreters than Matthew 24 and its parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21. Now, I really think that Expositor's Bible Commentary is a great set, and I think there's a lot of gems in there to be found. I've got the electronic version now in a Bible software program, but I had collected a number of them in hardbound copy going back 30 years ago. And when I got the electronic version, I donated the rest of them to whoever wanted them in the church. And this was years ago. And they were, some of you may have picked up one of them. I didn't have the complete set. It was a pretty expensive set in hardbound edition. But the electronic version is, you know, easier to work with and define something, and, you know, just reading the quote, I can just block and copy that quote and bring it into my thing. But it's funny that the one thing that through the years in the church that I would think is probably the greatest gift that Herbert Armstrong gave to the church, one of them among many, is the acknowledgement that the Bible interprets its own symbols, and you don't have to try to interpret it. You don't have to use your human reasoning or anything else. And that's one of the things that's always good for us as Bible students to remember, is that the Bible interprets its own symbols and helps us to understand it. And so what is really important is not just associating something on a topical basis in terms of modern-day relevancy and what's happening in the Middle East or Russia or China or the United States or Britain or anything else now. What's really important is understanding a basic outline. And that's what we'll do today as we prepare for the Holy Days, is to go through a basic outline of the important topics of Matthew 24. You could do this in a number of ways. I'll approach it this way, and Mr. LaRavia and Mr. Tannert could cover it in a slightly different way, and it would all be good. It would all be good. But we'll begin in Matthew 24, and just maybe I think I'll go to one other chapter later on. But Matthew 24, if you got your little Bible, you know, your little, what do they call that thing, the little thread that, what's that called? Forget. That little marker. Yeah, what is it? Is that what it, you got yours right there. Yours is silver. Mine have been various colors, but you may want to hold your place in Matthew 24 because we'll be coming back to that fairly often today. But we won't begin at the beginning of the chapter, but I think that an important message to be heard right away is in verse 4, where Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." So it's been like almost 2,000 years since he told his disciples that they should not be deceived. It certainly has stood the test of time. Verse 11 says, at the time of the end, that there will be many false prophets who will rise up and deceive many. So it's important to remember that we are given this instruction to help us avoid deception, to help us to avoid the problems. And again, I could name names. I won't, to protect the guilty. I could name those names of individuals who've gone off the deep end. And I'm sorry for them, but they have. And they've, you know, regularly tried to interpret the Bible and come up with various additional explanations. And when you do that, you really run a risk. This chapter is probably the single greatest chapter of Bible prophecy in the end time in some ways, because it ties in so many prophetic threads from other places. And we'll go to some of those other places today. And so that's basically what we're going to do. Use the Olivet Prophecy and help coordinate, as the Bible helps explain its own symbols, the prophecies of the end time, which are not meant to scare us to death, and they're not meant, as we in times past previously thought, tried to get us to pay attention to world events. I remember that was a big focus when I came into the church. Make sure you, every household, it wasn't maybe preached in every pulpit of Worldwide Church of God, but make sure you get a weekly news magazine. And I know that our news departments at that time, we read all of them. Time magazine, there are three great news magazines, you know, going back to the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Time magazine, probably considered the most liberal. Newsweek magazine, not quite so liberal, but pretty liberal still. The gold standard, U.S. News and World Report. And I don't think really any of them exist now that much in printed fashion. Maybe Time does. I think U.S. News and World Report and Newsweek long bit the dust, and, you know, people just don't buy magazines that much but they may exist in the online form. But there's many different areas in which you can get your news reports. But the main thing is that the encouragement to follow world events was to help prevent deception, which it's not going to do. So if you are an ardent follower of news events and world events, of it by itself, that's not going to help you to not be deceived, because it traditionally has not been a solid test of keeping you spiritually awake. Now, am I saying don't do it? No, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying don't use it as a substitute for what this prophecy encourages you to do, which is to stay spiritually vigilant. So in other words, given two extremes, being on a desert island and being stranded and having no access to the present news of the day, you would be better off to simply have your Bible and pay attention to it and to read it and study it and learn of the warnings held therein than you would be at the other extreme of being in the center of all news and having all the news reports you possibly could have, because that is not going to keep you spiritually vigilant. It may help you to be conversant in facts and details, which you should be. I'm not decrying that, but I'm just saying it's not a substitute for staying close to God. It says in verse 13, "He who endures to the end, the same shall be saved." This prophecy makes very clear and plain that some who have known these prophecies will ignore them, reject them, to their own peril. And if you jump ahead in the chapter to verse 44, it says, "Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect it." So if you're not expecting it, then just paying attention to news flashes is not going to help you. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant when his master, when he comes, will find so doing." So that so doing is being a Christian, remaining a Christian, following Christ, being a follower of Christ, doing the things that Christ taught us to do in every single aspect of his instruction. So let's go back to the beginning of the chapter now in verse 1. "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple." Christ had been teaching at the temple. Christ had been teaching about some of the things of those individuals who were prominent in the temple in the previous chapter in Matthew 23, known as the Woes chapter, telling them to avoid all of the things that he excoriates in this previous chapter of the scribes and the Pharisees, and to avoid their attitude and their practices. But the temple was important for them. And I think I've gone through in previous Bible studies, sermons through the years, about how important that temple was as a focal point of teaching and learning and people understanding the law. The law had been preserved there. There were the scrolls, there were the prophets, there were the writings, there was the Torah, there was everything there to help them to understand. There were copies made available so that people could understand that. And Christ came to that temple himself. It was now the rebuilt second temple with the Herod the Great, who had built onto it, and that construction process was still taking place that had begun in 20 A.D. You know, so it was a continuing thing, and it was a magnificent structure. There's no doubt about it. But now Christ was showing that the focal point of that teaching is changing. It was transitional, and then it had to be a number of years until that transition phase of where the education would spring from was really truly complete. So make no doubt about it. From a historical perspective, we know that the temple, the establishment of it in when it was finally rebuilt in 515 BC or 516 BC or thereabouts, we know that it was important as a physical site for the people of the day. And it would have to be in place because Jesus Christ was going to come to that temple in a physical way. But if you'll turn to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 18, we see the ramifications of what Christ was teaching. And all through the first part of the ministry of the apostles, this transitional phase was being talked about. Ephesians 2 and verse 18, and again, we're going to have to come back here to get this picture because the disciples in the next, you know, they came to show him the temple and to talk about its magnificence in Matthew 24. And Christ said, not one stone's going to be left upon another, as if to say, not so much importance should be placed on this physical building. Because the transition is that that temple was not going to be important at all. It was going to be a spiritual temple that would now be important. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. Christ, as it were, told his disciples that the foundational stones of this great Herodian temple would be overturned. That's not the foundation to be concerned about. Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Now, Ephesians was written in the 50s A.D. I don't have the exact date, and I haven't memorized it. It doesn't matter, but it would be about 15 to 20 years prior to the desolation of the temple in Jerusalem, because it would be overturned completely, and it would be a prior fulfillment of a number of different prophecies. But Christ was showing the disciples that he, not the temple itself, would be the center and the core in the life of his disciples. And so even though the temple continued to be central in the life of the Christian community, even many years later, up to 70 A.D., so much was changing that the book of Hebrews addresses this very same point. Because if you had been brought up to look to the temple and look to everything that it was, its presence in everyday life, if you hadn't had the book of Hebrews to warn you, how shocked would you be? As an individual, eventually you might, but again, the book of Hebrews helps explain what was going to happen. You know, a magnificent book, they're all great, but this book was helpful from the standpoint of helping people to understand that transition that would soon take place and what was going to be important. So if you were a Jew in the first century A.D. and towards the latter part of that, you know, the sixth decade of that, and then all of a sudden Roman armies came in, surrounded and ransacked the entire city, and that was a focal point of your life. If you didn't have this information, you would be pretty disappointed as to what was happening. So in Hebrews chapter 12, where it's emphasized, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners, etc., etc. Verse 22, speaking to an audience that was Jewish, where are you now? You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks of better things than that of Abel. The sacrificial system goes all the way back to the time just past the Garden of Eden to Abel, who brought forth the best of his flocks as a sacrifice to God. It's not codified as it was in the Levitical priesthood, but this would be very important to these folks at that time. Now, as an aside, even some in our church have speculated that, okay, will the sacrificial system be instituted during the time of the millennium? And I say no. Now, if somebody wants to argue that point, it's not worth, you know, getting into a tit for tat or anything. Sacrifices are mentioned in prophetic utterances in the Bible and talking about this 1,000 years of the world tomorrow that we talk about. I will not deny that. However, I feel that it's symbolic in nature, because why would we need, in the presence of the Lamb, to have a physical reminder if we don't have a physical, we don't need a physical reminder of circumcision if it's not a required spiritual attribute from a physical standpoint? Why would we need to go back and sacrifice goats and lambs and so on forth to get the message across that sin requires the penalty of death? So I don't see it. Maybe I'll have to be reeducated, but I'm not going to pin my hopes one way or another, but I'm just saying that's a personal feeling. But that sacrificial system is now, there's a beautiful transition throughout this whole book where the author, we believe to be Paul, I believe to be Paul, makes a beautiful case in a number of places to show that there is this transitional phase from what we did in the past to what we look to now. We've got this much better sacrifice that is taking place. Or that has already taken place, and that is the sacrifice that the New Testament church points to, not the blood of lambs, bulls, goats, whatever. See that you do not refuse him who speaks, for if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, how much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven? That's the message to the New Testament church in verse 28. It says, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Is that a foreshadowing of what would happen in the future? What would happen at the time of the encircling of armies around Jerusalem and the ransacking of the entire city and the destruction, finally, of that temple, which has been never really been rebuilt? There are parts of the walls that are still there intact, but the area in which the temple was thought to have been is now the site of one of the most holy of places in all of Islam, the Dome of the Rock. And so who knows what will happen without. But in 70 AD, before this book was completed, that temple was destroyed, and God prepared the church that was living at that time in Jerusalem for this momentous event. And if you'll turn back to Matthew 24 now, he told them of all of the things that would happen prior to his coming. And now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. These signs are also shown in Revelation 6. They're coordinated in the same way, and that's when I came into the church, that was one of the first things that I began to understand about Bible prophecy, was this ability of Mr. Armstrong to coordinate these two chapters, significant chapters in the book, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as they are called. Not really the, what was it, the offensive line of Notre Dame back in the 40s. It was also called the four horsemen of the apocalypse, or, you know, some allusion to college football. But these things have been in existence since all of mankind has lived. You know, wars, rumors of wars, religious deception, famine, pestilence, earthquakes, all of that. I haven't really done any research into the area of earthquakes. I know in Oklahoma they seem to be having more than they've had in past times, whether that's coincidental or whether it's some kind of geological disturbance or whether it's the result of what some people think is the result of fracking, which I highly doubt, but I could be wrong on that. But at any rate, in verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. So the persecution of the true church of God is described vividly here and somewhere else in the Bible. You should know where it is. Revelation 12, you do know where it is. This is one of the places in which shows that that tribulation is going to occur. I'm not going to go into great detail about that, but it shows that at the time of the end, God's people will be persecuted. It's a very interesting chapter. It talks about not just the people of God, but it also speaks about Israel, and it speaks in symbolic language, but the Bible always explains all of that. You can do your own Bible study, and you can find these symbols yourselves. The woman is mentioned, which is, there can be several references here. In this particular case, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. In this sense, it seems to be speaking not just symbolic of the church, but of the nation and the people of Israel. The garland of 12 stars gives it away, to a certain extent, the 12 tribes of Israel. But springing forth from one of those tribes, it says, then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon. And the early chapters of all the gospel accounts, or most of the gospel accounts, talk about how the death of the Christ child was the object of Herod the Great, and being deceived by the devil and the deception of the devil at this particular time. But God provided a way of escape for that Christ child, as we know, to be born. Verse 6 says, then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days, or 3.5 years, 1,260 days. Woman here is in reference to a church. And then we see this great conflagration between God and the devil, and the devil being cast out, and then going to find, because apparently he can't find all of them, so he finds the remnant of the seed of this woman. And, you know, we could speculate a lot. You could speculate a lot about who that is, what it is, and exactly when it will happen, but it's not that useful. In verse 13, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast out of the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. How does that happen? Well, historically through, it's not told here. Historically through history, persecution to the people of God have come from governments. And that could be where it happens in the time of the end. But the woman who was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time. So apparently for this entire time that is mentioned previously, she's protected by God. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. The earth swallowed, opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So, again, we could speculate as to, okay, who's protected, who's the object of the devil's enragement and that sort of thing. But the comforting fact is that these individuals that he's coming after are keeping the commandments of God, and they have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, I'm a chicken, okay? I don't want to be persecuted. So if you're asking me now, which camp do I want to be in? Persecuted? Not so much. Protected by God? That's where I want to be. Do we have a choice in the matter? It doesn't say. Well, the best that we can do is to do our best to follow the commandments of God, to follow Christ, to stay close to God, And whatever happens after that point is going to be what happens. So persecution, no, not so crazy about that. I mean, because we thought we were persecuted when we came into the church, some of us. We thought we were persecuted because our family persecuted us. As it turns out, our family questioned what we did. And our family sometimes, we offended them unknowingly. I know I did. I'm not speaking for everybody, but I know that I did. Looking back, I said things I shouldn't have said. I remember one time my brother was really in his zeal, and he was reading from Revelation 16 and 17 to all of us in the family, and he was impassioned. He was new in the faith and not even baptized himself, but reading through these momentous chapters in the book of Revelation. And he looked at me and my mother and he said, "Do you believe?" And I don't remember, "Do you believe that this is going to happen?" This is an example of zeal. And yeah, pretty much kind of lays it all out there. It looks like it's, going in that direction. And, do you want to come and learn more at Bible study? My mom said, "Yeah, I don't think so. I don't want to go to a Bible study." And, most people have been proud of this incredible delivery that my brother had in the newness of his faith when he asked my mother if she would change her mind when 100-pound hailstones began raining down on her head. We laugh about it now. I was scared. No, I don't want that. I'll go to Bible study with you. I'll go to the church picnic. I'll call the minister and ask for an appointment. Yes, that's me. I'm scared. I'm, kind of freaky like that. Don't like pain. But going back to Revelation chapter 3, all I can hope for is that my brother is not going to access this sermon online because he listens to my sermons online. Oh, well. We'll have to get to that bridge when we come to it. Everybody serves as an example of some kind, even if it's a bad one, right? Okay. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, These things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts and shuts and no one opens. So we know all of that. It says, in addition to that, in verse 9, indeed I will make those of the synagogue of Satan. The synagogue of Satan, what is that? A synagogue? I mean, a synagogue is where the Jews go to on the seventh day to keep the Sabbath day and to keep the Sabbath day holy. We've got a lot of synagogues around this town. We've got, and they run the gamut from being very liberal Jewish enclaves to very conservative Jewish enclaves. But this is a synagogue, not of the Jews or of the church, but it's a synagogue of Satan. Now, why is synagogue used? Because it says that these individuals say they are Jews, but they're not. But they lie. Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet to know that I have loved you because you kept the command to persevere. So, in the family of God, people are going to be brought by God, people who have erred at some point. Obviously, they're going to come and worship before the God family. But these individuals, it says, are those who have been in a synagogue of the devil. And it further explains that they say they're Jews, but they're really not. So how does the Bible interpret this? Let's go back to Romans chapter 3, first of all. Romans 3, we see that Paul asks this question. What advantage then has the Jew? There were Jews in the church at Rome at that time. There were Gentiles. There were Romans in the church at Rome at that time. And a lot of them were mentioned by name in the last few chapters. Say hi to this person, to that person, to Peter. Say hi to Peter. Say hi to the Apostle Peter when you see him. So I know that he went there before I did and founded my church. Founded our church. No, he doesn't say anything about Peter. which is interesting, right? No comment. Did he not like Peter? I think they liked each other. Peter hadn't been there. That's why. So what advantage then, that's an aside, what advantage then has the Jew or what profit of circumcision? Going through some of this physical stuff, doing what the Jews did, is there any profitability toward it in any way? And Paul said, much, much in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. And if some of them didn't believe it, doesn't matter. But they were given the writings of God, and they were to preserve those writings. And so being a Jew was considered to be an advantage to some degree if God called you, because you would have a background in a lot of things. Trying to think of a modern day counterpart or parallel, but none really comes to mind right now. But it would have a leg up on the situation because they understood pretty much the commandments, the Sabbath, the holy days, not an issue. It's just that, as Hebrews brings out, there's a transitional period where you have to understand the reason for things that were done anciently and the things that aren't going to be done now. They're not going to have any sacrifices. Why? Because Hebrews 4 explains it. Hebrews 4, 14 through 16. We've got an eternal throne that we can go to. So if you back up to verse 29, it helps us to answer the question as to what the Apostle John was speaking about in the book of Revelation in verse 29 of chapter 2. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly. So being Jewish, you could all say, no matter what color, race, creed, or whatever you are, from a spiritual standpoint, you're all Jews. All of you are Jews. You've been brought into Jerusalem. Spiritually, you're Jews, because Paul said he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. So the synagogue that John speaks about in Revelation pretends it's an imposter from a spiritual standpoint in the time of the end. It's pretending to be Jewish. In other words, it's pretending to be the original Christian church. At the time of the end, there will be a group who say that they are the original Christian church. And maybe even they'll say that Peter was our first pope. And they will claim to be the church of God in the time of the end. Now, it's kind of hard for us to envision that because we live in a multicultural society and system where there are many churches, there are many Christian churches. We know they all have their liabilities if they're not the true church of God, but it's hard for us to contemplate or to fathom a time that would be similar to a time hundreds of years after the time of the Apostle Paul and John and all of the disciples, in which this church would become prominent and thought of to be the Christian church. Now, there are many Christian churches, but again, it's maybe hard for us to conceptualize, but there's a church that is prophesied to be the proponents of Christianity, but yet they will be extremely deceptive. So this synagogue that John speaks about in Revelation pretends to be that from a spiritual standpoint, but in the time of the end. But it's not. It's not God's church at all. But it's part of the deception that Christ mentions in Matthew 24 and other places, as we're going to get there as well. In verse 15 of Matthew 24, it says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," sorry, another translation I put in there, I forgot to mention, "then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go there, but this prophecy has two aspects. They're covered, the first one is covered in Daniel 11 and in verse 31. Well, actually, both of them are mentioned there in Daniel and verses beginning in Daniel 11 and verse 31. It goes back to the time of 168 BC, where this successor to the Alexandrian Empire, and in this case, Antiochus Epiphanes, desecrated the second temple in Jerusalem by purportedly placing a statue of Jupiter, the Greek god, in the midst of the temple, desecrating it, and it had to be cleansed later from, you know, that period when they recovered. But there are two aspects of what makes the city of Jerusalem desolate. One of them is mentioned in the text, Luke 21 and verse 20, in that companion or parallel Olivet prophecy. Christ said, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." It's happened a couple of times through history. It undoubtedly happened in 168 AD, BC. I'll be right. 168 BC. And it happened again in 70 AD, where the armies of, what was it, Trajan, who's the general or the emperor at that time in Rome, encircled the armies, and that's when Jerusalem was ransacked. That's when the temple was destroyed, the rebuilt Herodian temple, that is. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. So the abomination that makes desolate, it's mentioned in the book of Matthew, is twofold. From a religious point of view, it appears as though, and although we can't really see how this is going to happen, how there could be a modern-day temple or how there could be a modern-day holy place, because there's not. There's the Wailing Wall. It's very hard to imagine that the Wailing Wall being desecrated, destroyed, would be the object of this prophecy. So although we don't see on the horizon a rebuilt or even a movement to rebuild that temple, it's possible that it could happen again. And it's possible that it could happen at the Dome of the Rock, although that would cause such furor that, I mean, that would be like an international furor, which could actually cause armies to surround Jerusalem. Oh, I said I wouldn't speculate. Okay. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, even more important than that. And this is this is a more modern counterpart of what I call the hysteria of Watergate, which seems like a non sequitur. But you remember when Watergate happened? I don't know if you were in the church then at that particular time, but in Hezekiah's time, there was a Watergate mentioned in the Bible. And so people got excited, you know, they went to their Strong's Concordance, because we didn't have computers in those days, and they found the term Watergate in the Bible and somehow tried to make some crazy association with the words Watergate and an office building in Washington, D.C. on the shores of the Potomac. That was nutty. If you weren't around, you were spared of that. Okay, so unequally silly idea in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 of more recent vintage. An association trying to be made, if people really don't understand the symbolism of the Bible. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, this all has to do with that deceptive phase that Christ spoke about in Matthew 24. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us that the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. It further explains who this person's going to be, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshiped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. The key words, above all that is called God or that is worshiped, so that he sits as God. Now, he sits as God, as it were, in the temple of God, not the true temple of God. The man of sin is not going to appear in the church. The man of sin is going to arise on the world scene according to the other prophecies that you can easily research in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. You know, Paul says, do you not remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? However, not too long ago, a number of years ago, there were some who adamantly proclaimed that this happened within the church of God, and it was a reason for the deception, but they failed to comprehend that this is a man of sin. He's going to have great power. He's going to have supernatural power at his disposal, even as it says of the same individual that he's going to be imbued with the powers of the devil, so powerful that he will deceive the entire world. Verse 9, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now, I'll be the first to admit that the church of God has never been perfect. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. Its leaders have never been perfect. But we've never really had anybody, nor will we ever have to fear having somebody rise up within the true church of God having satanic power. That's not going to happen. So, I remember when this theory first came out that this is what was happening, the church, I knocked it into a cocked hat then, said anybody who purported that is totally nuts, which they are, and it didn't ever happen, and it hasn't happened. Now, we don't have a perfect ministry except for the ministry of that one Jesus Christ, and we have never had strong delusion that people would believe it a lie within the church. Now, people may have believed lies, but not a strong delusion. It hasn't really happened. So who is this individual? Notice what it says in the verses. It says that this is a man of lawlessness. Now, although some people have, obligated the law to no effect, it shows that Satan is going to be within this individual. He's called the man of destruction. He opposes everything about God. He's also explained in Daniel 8, by the way. The books of Daniel, Matthew 24, Revelation, they all combine with one another. Paul said that he had talked to them about that and that it was going to happen. That individual is going to be destroyed at the coming of Jesus Christ. Daniel 2:44 says the same thing, as does Revelation 19, verses 19 through 21, I'll just cite for you so you can jot down and put in your notes, or preferably in the margins of your Bible. Along with all that speculation of years past. I figure you're on safe ground if you write it in your margins. And we were taught to mark our Bibles when I came into the church. And after a couple of years, you had to buy a new Bible, just to keep up. And you had to buy a new Bible because all the other things that you had put in that were speculative never came to pass. And so you need to get rid of that. Okay, just kidding. Don't get rid of your Bible. Revelation chapter 13. I know that for many of you, this is really kind of basic stuff, but we all need to be reminded of it from time to time. In verses 11 through 14, it says, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. This is the person that it's speaking of in 2 Thessalonians. This is the individual. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. That will arise within this false Jewish church or Christian church, those who claim to be Jews but are not. They'll be deceived. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Now lived. We let the Bible interpret itself. This same individual is mentioned in Daniel 8. You can read that. Daniel 8, verses 23 through 27. And shows what's going to happen to him. Guess what? It shows that individual receives the same fate as this individual in Revelation 13 and in 2 Thessalonians 2, and it's the same person, one and the same. The individual is, Daniel says, this vision is true, and it remains for many days into the future, so into the time of the end. Daniel was astonished by the vision. He was sick for many days after seeing it, so it must have been kind of a horrible thing. We will reach a time when the world will see that it has a great crisis on its hands. Now, I don't know when that time is going to happen, and I suspect that anybody who projects and says that it's going to happen by a certain time, which, by the way, I remember as early as 1997 in a sermon of the feast, that by 2006, Christ would have already returned. That was a sermon at the feast. And it's so easy to project into the future, and it's so easy for those of us who are living at this present day and age to think, wow, how bad can things get? No, they can't get much worse than they are until they do, and then you say, oh, they are bad. And then you think, they can't get much worse than they are now, but then they do. And then all of a sudden something else happens, and wait a minute, things are better now than they were. The crime rate is actually down. I'm not saying it happens now, but that's happened throughout history. You could have gone, after I visited New York City in 1975 on a trip when I was in college, the city was a relatively safe city. And then it began a slide into several decades of incredible crime and murder. And then guess what? Rudy Giuliani came into power in the mayor's office, and they cleaned up the streets. And New York was a relatively, I'm not saying I want to live there or anything, but as a city, it was relatively safe. Now it's kind of sliding back down into that morass of more crime and more murders, and the same thing is true in Chicago. So things get better, things get worse, and we have a tendency, and I'm just like everybody else, to evaluate and look at the time in which we live as being, wow, this can't get much worse now, or can it? Well, it probably can, and it's going to. We know that. It can probably always get worse. But in Matthew 24 and verse 42, Christ said this importantly. Watch therefore. Okay, pay attention to these things as they happen, but more particularly, pay attention to yourself and where you are. And if anything, use current events, use the prophecies of the Bible to motivate you to be a better Christian, not to be a better student of prophecy, but to be a better Christian, so that because we don't know what hour our Lord is coming, we do stand at the gates and we look at them maybe several years off, maybe many years off into the future. We just don't know. But these things are going to come to pass, and God help us to be aware of the time and age in which we live.